Hello, everyone. I'm Nate Truax, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome to back to the CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host, Nate. And today I'm joined by Dr. Christina Zdenek, instructor and co-owner of the Australian Reptile Academy. Dr. Christina, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So do you want to get us started off on how you first got into reptiles and kind of your career and what you led up to this point?
Yeah, sure. It's been a long journey. It started probably how a lot of other people in reptiles, and that's from a really young age. So I got hooked probably from around the age of eight. A constrictor. It was so big, and I was so small that my mother thought that when which occasionally it did, that it would eat me. And so she was terrified. But fortunately, my dad wanted us to have a relationship with nature and to respect it and honor it. And I just took that to a whole nother level. All my siblings, they all do random other things. I'm the only one who like does anything with wildlife conservation or snakes. But anyway, after having snakes as pets, which I highly recommend, they're great. Then I moved over to Australia after doing my undergrad. Me to research wildlife conservation out here, so I wanted to make a difference for trees and habitats. And I just saw such a huge need for research and conservation and education in the snake space, because there was a long way to go, and there still is. So various things that I did was traveling around, educating the public at outdoor events where the community comes and has what's called like an outdoor day, agricultural day, that sort of thing. So I was teaching people about snakes. I was doing snake shows. And so traveling around doing that for 8 years seasonally, that was pretty good fun. You know, got to learn really what people think about snakes and what makes them think that way. And it really was a good foundation for starting a PhD. I ended up doing a PhD on snake venom, Australian snake venoms and anti-venom efficacy and that sort of thing. But I embedded ecology of Australian death adders into that. So I had to do a whole heap of venom extractions and field work and tracking snakes and all the ecology. And so that was really good. And done various scientific papers about snakes, including how they respond to airborne sounds. And I guess more recently, for the past about 4 years, just been running the Australian Reptile Academy as an aside to other full-time work. But yeah, that's where we train people in the safe and ethical handling of venomous snakes. So I guess that is probably a bit of an introduction of me and my relationship with snakes over the course of my life.
All right, and you mentioned you did a lot of work with Australian death adders. Here in the States, you kind of hear of death adders being kind of this almost halfway point between a lapid and a pit viper almost, and how they behave and like their dentition and everything. Can you talk a little more about your work with death adders and what makes them special?
Yeah, absolutely. So death adders, that's the genus Acanthophis. Worked on Antarcticus, and specifically in an area, so Acanthophis Antarcticus, called Magnetic Island. And that's because, like, it drew me there because I heard from the locals that they're in pretty good numbers, which is hard to come by when it comes to death adders. They're one of the first species to move out of an area or not be able to occupy disturbed landscapes. Magnetic Island was different. There was a lot of bushland, small little island, only 8 kilometers wide, and there's like 3,000 residents. It's like there's not too many people living there. So anyway, it's a beautiful place, and so I decided to do some research. Like, we know that they're listed as vulnerable at the state level within Queensland, and so we're wondering, you know, how are they faring with cane toads? So when they eat cane toad, importantly, you know, can I help reduce this human snake conflict that I was hearing? Dogs to death adder bites, and, you know, people gardening and lifting up a pile of leaves and having a death adder in the face, you know, that sort of thing. So that was a real interest for me. It took a while to win any sort of grant money to say, yeah, 2.5 years it took me to win only $14,000, and you're supposed to like change the world and everything you know about it, like with just the smallest amount of money. Anyway, yeah, it was a great project. I had some really good volunteers coming on board. So he's a co-owner of Australian Reptile Academy with me, and he ended up continuing the field work there for another, yeah, tracking snakes for another 3.5 weeks beyond what we did. So it was a total of 8 weeks we were tracking the animals. I would have loved to have done it for a whole year and loads of, you know, sample sizes, but of course the trackers are expensive, your labor is expensive, and yeah, you can only really probably one person track 10 animals a day. So interesting data that you can get out of it.
Okay, and what were some of your findings with your research?
Yeah, so we published one of the two papers so far, and one of it's about the technique that we use. It's called the subdermal stitch method, and we found that it's really important that you need to have a pilot study for each species in each habitat. That's what our strong recommendation was. We had some issues with the snakes just not having the strength to pull through when there was any sort of catching of this external transmitter. And the snakes we actually found to be a dwarf population, and that was a significant result. So compared with the mainland, they are significantly smaller on the island. And you see this in, you know, a lot of sort of island biogeography sort of studies, where you get these isolated populations, and based on, you know, the parameters there and what prey availability and, you know, the amount of calories available to you, like there's not that many mammals at all on the island, but there's all these little skinks. And we noticed that the death adders, they were just hunting skinks the whole time, and there's not much to a skink. So we think they're just growing a lot slower because they're not having this much more fattier source of food that would be like little and hopping up for any future research going forward. And then we looked at their home range and whether translocating these animals, you know, what impact that would have on them. Because the literature has shown that basically any time any snake's being translocated from where its home range is, it doesn't often fare well for the snake. It increases their risk of predation, getting run over by cars, increase in their movement patterns and that sort of thing. But we're wondering, okay, well, how an ambush predator, you know, so something that we know isn't an active forager. They sit and wait for their food to come to them. We suspect they have a small home range. And that's indeed what we found. We found very little movement of the, it was still extremely hard to find them, as a side note. Like even in a square meter, you're like, oh my God, where's the snake? I know it's right here. But anyway, like the biggest movement we had of an individual overnight was 32 meters. So that, what's that? Like 95 feet or something like that for the American audience. So we found that when they go to shed, they fly and some of the movement patterns, and yeah, they need a safe place to be able to just hunker down in that moment or that period of shedding their skin. So yeah, one of the findings that might be of interest to people is that death adders, traditionally you read the books and they say they're nocturnal, and you know, so that's when the rest of it, but we'd also be tracking them during the day to find out where they're hiding, and to get a GPS, you know, fix on each of these animals, and found them actively, regularly hunting during the day. And so this whole putting these animals into boxes of nocturnal versus diurnal, it really fails in the case of death adders. And I suspect a lot more animals, in fact, you know, like I watch powerful owls. This is Australia's biggest owl, and you often see them awake during the day, and they might feed a little bit here and there. And yes, they're not actively like hunting and doing this sort of thing, but they don't quite fit the bill of what people think of. So I think that's an important eye opener, is that what we think's going on is that they do these big movements if they're going to reposition where they're hunting or go find the shelter side, the female, whatever it might be, depending on the season, that they do these bigger movements at night to avoid the probably aerial predators, particularly birds, during the day. But it doesn't mean that an ambush predator can't hunt during the day, which is when their food source, mind you, is active. So for them, it's skinks, and we found that through the fecal float. So we analyzed their feces as well, and we found just loads of scales, and only one out of I think eight fecal samples had any bit of hair in it at all. So they are definitely feeding on skinks, and they feed during the day, despite them being a quote unquote nocturnal animal. So there you go. Now we know more about death adders. How good.
Yeah, I was going to say it makes sense for an ambush predator. It doesn't really matter what time of day you're hunting. If you find your perfect little hidey hole, you just sit there, and it doesn't matter what time of day someone comes by. If you're hungry, you grab it.
Exactly. You've got to take that opportunity when it comes to you. And, especially if you're eating skinks and there's not much fat to them, you're going to need all the opportunities you can get. Especially if you're a female and you need that extra energy to have the babies, you're going to want to be hunting as much as possible and have the highest success as possible, that's for sure.
Yeah. And you said your research with death adders was also on their venom, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I published a paper looking at the neurotoxicity and so particularly these three finger toxins that they have, and what that's a type of small peptide that they've got in their venom, and we looked at the target specificity of that. So we had a non-animal model, which was really great, using a machine called an octet, and you basically it's a dip and read sort of system where you have an artificial receptor that you have synthesized, and anyway, we could. Different taxa are slightly different combinations of amino acids and shapes and that sort of thing. And so you can test to see whether these venom toxins, these peptides within the venom, bind preferentially to certain taxon or others. So, are they more likely to target skinks, skink lizards, or birds, or mammals, fish, and then human as well? Like, what's that look like? And so, yeah, we were able to test that, and we found that they have really broadly applicable venom, doesn't really target any specific taxon. So our interpretation of that is it makes sense for an ambush predator to not be super selective on its venom, and instead have its venom be just as potent on whatever sort of comes by in order to help immobilize that prey and to take it down, as opposed to, in contrast, some other research I had on king cobras using that same dip and read system. We found that their venom hugely preferentially targets the snake receptor, alpha-1 nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, for anyone who much into biology and venom and that sort of thing. So that's the target we were looking at, and with king cobras, it just lit up like a Christmas tree on the snake receptor, and very little on any of the other receptors. But in contrast, yeah, death adders, it was very broad spectrum specificity. So that was a really cool outcome of that paper.
Okay, and do you notice, I don't know, did you do any like venom extraction or samples from the Magnetic Island population?
I did not extract venom from Magnetic Island population. I was planning on it, but my supervisor at the time unfortunately let his permit lapse, and I found out 8 days prior to the. So that was quite unfortunate, and I needed to almost rethink my entire research question because it was going to be about venom, and I needed to just completely pivot in a very short period of time. Yeah, which was took a hit for sure, but I ended up having to come back for another field season. But yeah, found some funding for that. So no is the short answer. Did not extract venom from them because I didn't have, but I extracted from data which hadn't been done before, including the relatively new edition, the Cryptomydrus one. So that paper hasn't come out yet. So there's just no longer that's no longer part of the remit of what I'm doing. So it's difficult to spend the money and do these things when you're obligated to who's paying your bills. So hopefully that comes out at some stage. Comparing all the species, the death adders, their specificity and their relative potency of their neurotoxic venom.
Yeah, I was gonna say it'd be really interesting to find if isolated island populations have slightly different venom composition versus mainland populations.
Absolutely, it would be a great question. I would suspect that they possibly could have evolved to target lizards a little bit more potently than all the other ones, because that's what we found that they were eating. That would confer a selective advantage for those populations there, just because of what lives on that island. But yeah, we weren't able to do that at this stage, but that would certainly be a question for the future.
All
And
right.
of course, this could have some implications for how venom affects humans. Like if
Yeah.
they're, for instance, if the venom targets mammals, well, we're a mammal too, and so our receptors are a lot closer in shape and an immune sequence than say other ones. So yeah, it's if they target mammals, there's a greater chance that it's going to have a more negative effect on humans as well. I mean, you look at eastern brown snakes and they target rats and mice, and it's no wonder why it's such a potent venom on humans and can kill them quite rapidly.
Yeah. Speaking of your other research, you mentioned you did work on seeing how snakes respond to airborne sound. You want to touch on that a little briefly?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so this was research that my colleagues and I published. I think it was 2021, maybe 2022. And we looked for the first time ever at how free moving snakes responded to airborne sound. And it's crazy to think that no one's ever done this before, but it is quite difficult, especially when you're talking about all these venomous snakes. Like, so in the past, what researchers have done is basically just studied one species of rattlesnake, and they put them in like these hanging baskets and anesthetize them partially so that they can put surgically implant electrodes into their brains to see whether there was electrical responses potentials in response to airborne sounds. And that research indicated that yes, they did, and it was at lower frequencies. So it was a good stepping stone for us to be able to then know what frequencies to play to our snakes. But what we wanted to know was how they actually, what they thought of these sounds, like what their behavior, how that changed according to these sounds. And so we needed to isolate the sounds, make sure they weren't just hearing it through or feeling it right in their scales, through the vibrations in the ground, but actually literally through the air. That's just another medium where these sound waves and vibrations can travel. And we know snakes have internal middle ears, so maybe they are hearing things. Maybe. So we tested 19 snakes from six different genera. And so we had multiple representatives of each species. Of course, it would be wonderful if you had like sort of six individuals of every species, but like who's just got like, 60 snakes on hand? This is incredibly difficult, right? And animal ethics is stopping us left, right, and center at universities, these committees. So it's extremely difficult to do almost anything with animals that have a vertebrae. But yeah, anyway, we managed to get these ethics approval to research our snakes, and yeah, we played them these different sounds, and they were different frequencies, and they were just sort of like broad, like sort of sounds, in order to make it manageable. We had 309 different trials, so we spent weeks and weeks there was so much contact handling that Chris Hay had to do. Like, it was literally a year's worth of contact handling squished into 3 weeks. And fortunately, there wasn't a bite. But yeah, we were able to find some interesting findings. Like, certain species, they would actually approach the sounds, while others, they would actually be agitated and had these real defensive responses towards sounds. Other ones, they tended to go away. And so it was a real interesting result. And I hope that other researchers can use it as a stepping springboard, you know, stepping stone onto researching snakes. There's so little, really huge group of animals across the world. And it's just, you know, less loved. They're a little bit out of sight, hard to find, and often underfunded. So I can understand where, you know, we're at the place we are. But yeah, it would be nice to see more research on snakes. And the more we, you know, put information, you know, evidence-based information about snakes, the better we can combat all these myths and, you know, unfairly maligned attitudes towards snakes.
Yeah. And what were there any broad generalizations you noticed? Like, say, they're more sensitive to picking up low-frequency sound versus high-frequency sound, or say, like, diurnal species maybe more defensive versus nocturnal species being more inquisitive, or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll go into a little bit more deeper for you. So we found that a species of python, it's called the Woma python, they actually had a curious sort of response to the sound. They would erect up into a periscope sort of behavior, and they significantly more so went toward the sound as opposed to away from the sound. So we randomized which side of the room that the sound was coming from, so it's not like they just wanted to go that direction. And so we could account for all these things, and yeah, it still came out as significant. So Woma pythons, generally nocturnal animals, semi-arboreal. They're an arid interior species, can get up to 2 meters. It would take decades to get that long, generally like 1.5 sort of max. But yeah, this species, they weren't intimidated by the sound. Instead, they were curious. And the way that we interpret that is looking at the ecology of the animal, that being a larger animal, and the individuals that we're testing, they were large. They're probably more of a top predator in there, especially at night when you haven't got these raptors, you know, flying overhead. And so, you know, any sort of movement or action that might be prey for them as opposed to a predator for themselves. So that was quite interesting. Death adders, they tended to go away from the sound, which is interesting because being an ambush predator, you're vulnerable to being trampled on. So if something is, like, you know, moving and you can feel it, and, you know, even the vibrations that apparently weren't causing ground vibrations, they still moved away. And it could be that our accelerometer that we tested wasn't as sensitive as the lower jawbone of the death adder, because they have this hoop-like low set jaw that is, like, fully in contact with the ground. And I think there's some interesting work that can be done there. So I think they're super in tune to what's around them. And if something is big coming toward them and they don't want to get trampled on, then they want to move out the way. Coastal taipan, so that's Oxyrhynchus scutellatus, they became quite defensive. They went into these behavior modes where they've got, sorry about that dog nearby, I can't do anything about it. So coastal taipans, they tended to be more defensive when we played them these sounds. And so one behavior that they did is called fixation. And that's where the animal, it's facing the direction of the sound, or they may have interpreted as a predator. And then they're slowly moving their body sideways, but keeping that head fixated on the direction of where that stimulus is coming from. And so, you know, someone who handles a lot of snakes and has done for many years, if you ever see that in a taipan, you just stay completely still, because they are ready to strike and they're scared. And you don't want a scared taipan, because they might become very defensive, right? So that was an interesting result, that they would significantly more so display these defensive behaviors. There was hissing as well from the brown snakes. And that was an interesting case. So Pseudonia textilis, they sort of, it was all or nothing for them. And it really pairs super nicely with what we see in terms of their reaction to people walking past them. So Whitaker and Shine's paper from 1997, they looked at the reaction of eastern brown snakes to people walking, and it was like they either stood still or they do this all-out sort of reaction. And it's kind of like, you know, if you push the buttons hard enough, they will defend themselves in a fierce manner. And that's what we saw with these sounds. We saw them either completely stay still, maybe do some hissing, where the whole body sort of contracts and pushes the air out to sort of alert a predator, hey, I'm here. You kind of don't want to get near me if you can help yourself. Or they would just bolt, and they do these big, quick, rapid movements in one direction. So like 2 meter movement sort of thing. So that was a fascinating result.
I was going to say, with that inland taipan, it's like, well, not inland, coastal taipan, my bad. But yeah, you don't want to scare a taipan, because a scared taipan is a scary taipan.
Oh, yeah. That's the number one rule with handling coastal taipans, is keep them happy. Because basically, if they want to, if it's a decent size animal, if they want to bite you, they can and will. Yeah, so we keep it nice and calm, cool, and collected with them.
Yeah, no, I'll just stick to garter snakes up here in the States. Thank you very much.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I don't have Boma pythons. I obviously don't have any Australian lapids, but I do have carpet pythons. So I was kind of curious, and did you do any research on carpet pythons? And were carpet pythons involved in that snake sound study?
No, we didn't. We didn't have any of those species on hand. That would be interesting, especially because there is a huge human-snake conflict with regards to that species in particular. And we've got another paper hopefully coming out by the end of the year looking at this specifically. But they are the species that's most removed in Southeast Queensland. And so it would be interesting to learn a little bit more about them. And unfortunately, we had to limit the study, and we didn't possess any in our care at that time, so we weren't able to include it, and we were limited. Like, we had to do the study in a soundproof room that's quite expensive to hire out. Unfortunately, our collaborator was the head of the school of sound and art and something or other. I forget the exact name of it, but that was quite handy, because he just used a lot of his allotment of, you know, time renting of these very special expensive rooms in order to support our research. But we had to limit the length of time. I think it was, we had like 3 weeks. So we weren't able to include carpet pythons, but future people, that'd be a good one. How big is your carpet python?
I have a couple of, I don't even know what they're called anymore, like maybe Iron Jaya or Transfly River carpets, like the ones you find up in New Guinea. I have a male who's probably a meter long, maybe a little bit more than a meter long. And then a couple of younger females, one's maybe 50, 60 centimeters, and the other one's like 30 centimeters.
Oh, I'm sure they're beautiful. It's that's one benefits living in the States. You can have exotic reptiles. Here in Australia, you can't have any. There's like very few exceptions. They've just been grandfathered in. Some people have managed to convince the government, live on like Australian islands. You can have Varanus prasinus, for instance, or like white-lip pit vipers, and it would be pretty cool to live in a place where you can have exotic snakes. I'm a little bit jealous, to be honest.
Well, you guys could also get parentes, and those are pretty much non-existent over here, so I'm kind of jealous of that.
Oh, my God, they're the best. They're so gorgeous and smart, and, yeah, they take a lot of care in, like, a huge area, so a lot of people wouldn't be suitable to keeping them. If they stayed, like, 2 feet long, man, they'd be popular, but they get huge.
So at the can you describe some of your work with the Australian Reptile Academy?
Yeah, sure. We've been operating for 7 years now, and what we do is train people in the safe and ethical handling of Australian venomous. And we tell people handling Australian venomous snakes is no joke, so definitely leave it to the professionals. And then you ask yourself, well, how do the professionals get trained? Well, it's us. We train the snake catchers, the fauna spotter catchers, the ecologists, the vets, vet nurses, and even just university students interested in wildlife as well, wildlife carers, and even people who want to just manage snakes on their own property if they live out where there's no snake catchers available or they can't afford them on a regular. So a range of people we train, and it's a full day course. So we limit the number of students, and it's Chris Hay and I are the instructors, and we start with some theory. And we start it slow and we work people up. And yeah, we do these courses, but we also do a range of education for the public. So we sometimes do these community workshops when they're, trying to understand how to better live and coexist with snakes. For instance, if there's a snake bite death in the community and everyone's scared and they want to, have trustworthy evidence-based information. And that's what we provide. And like we've got another one where we're going to be training council workers. So these are local government employees who are out there doing the management of parks and gardens and pathways. And so they need to know how to identify a snake, what it is, so that they can assess the risk and then maybe they can manage that as well themselves. So yeah, a range of stuff that we do. We provide snakes for media as well. We do some television work here and there. So yeah, a few different things we do at the Rep Academy. Sometimes are involved with research, like other researchers around the world need some samples from something like that. And yeah, we're definitely open to that. And yeah, all about snakes, that's for sure.
So what would you say is your most frequent job at the academy?
I'd say most often compared with the other tasks is like our main thing is doing the venomous snake handling training. We do that about once a month. There was 1 month where we had four courses. That was pretty intense. But usually it's about once a month. And sometimes we travel as well. So sometimes we have to fly with our snakes. And yeah, so we just have got a demand to fill in another city. And the snakes have to come with us. Like it can become a little bit expensive. Like you wouldn't believe how expensive it is to ship live animals on a plane. It actually costs as much as shipping two people on the plane. So, but yeah, no, we that's probably the main thing is
Second, but
okay.
what we say are maybe not all, but what are some of your most prominent species that you keep at the Academy?
Our most prominent one is coastal taipans. So we've got five individuals, coastal
Oh,
taipans.
you
They're
really
from
like playing with
typical.
fire.
Yeah, and sometimes it is, I tell you, it's a couple individuals, and we've had to have pretty serious conversations, Chris and I, about how to manage the behavior. Like if they throw temper tantrums, we call them, like sometimes they have a bad day. And we need to be aware which animals are capable of that and what sort of things, what activities they don't like, whether it be putting into a bin or putting them back into the enclosure or any smell of bleach, like the key to safety for us is knowing the individuals. They all have their own personalities and, knowing that and knowing staying one step and gives us the safety edge that we need. So an example would be, just to give a concrete example for your listeners, a snake by the name of Boss. So I've named her Boss because she's absolutely the boss. She is got to be 2.1 meters. We're going to properly measure her in a few weeks, actually. But she's a coastal taipan, so Ocurrena scutellatus, And she is huge. Like for a female to get that huge, it is very impressive. And she's got the weight on her. She's so healthy, beaming. She's maroon, or you'd say maroon in the States, color, absolutely gorgeous. But she has this thing about her where you can't force the issue. If you want her to come out and you just start pulling her and she's not into it, she will do this thrashing. And the problem with thrashing is twofold. One, she could hurt herself by whipping her head up against the bin and things, then bleed her gums out. The second issue is that there's no other step between thrashing and biting. So you're very close to a stage where she's just going to turn around and bite you. And that could very well be close to death for us, especially if we don't have Taipan-specific antivenom, which we know our nearby hospital doesn't. They would give us polyvalent antivenom. But anyway, so with her, it's giving her all the time in the world. She chooses when she wants to come out. So we just give her all the time. We introduce her to the hook, take it slow. We encourage her to come out. If she wants to go back, we just let her sit. And then we wait basically till she wants to come out, and we take it just ever so slowly. And we give her the impression that she's the one deciding what she's doing, and we're not pushing the envelope. So yeah, just one example of knowing the personality of animals, how that keeps us safe, and how we alter our standard operating procedures, personality of these individual snakes. It's pretty cool.
And besides the Atlantic taipans, what are some other species you keep? Do you keep like Eastern Browns or Red Belly Blacks or anything like that?
Oh yeah, that was coastal taipans, by the way. You keep gravitating toward inland taipans. Just fair enough. They're pretty cool.
Yes. Sorry, it's just the ones you always see glorified in the media for some reason.
Yes, especially over there. Oh no. And we do have one inland. His name is LD50. And man, he's huge. He's oh yeah. Yeah. One of my
That's such a good
cutest
name for an
little
Atlantic taipan.
guys. Yeah. Yeah, he's cute. Yeah, he was orphaned to us. A person couldn't care for him, and he was kind of on death's doorstep, to be honest. Tiger snake. We've got two eastern brown snakes, one of which is he's literally past 2 meters. He's like huge, this thing. He's got to be one of the biggest in captivity. His name's Upgrade, so that's pretty cool. We've got a strap-snouted brown snake, so it's Sudnaya spitorhynchus. We've got another species of black snake, the Colletts black snake, so Cydecus colletti. We've got the Butler's black snake, so Cydecus butleri. That one's gorgeous. He's kind of long and skinny, nothing like a mulga snake, although like closely related. So that one's quite interesting. What else we got? So we've got two pale-headed snakes. These are arboreal snakes. So that's Hoplocephalus bittor quatus. They should be listed as vulnerable to not. There's not enough research on it, and Queensland just keeps deforesting. It's like literally, if we're our own country, we'd be the second worst country for deforestation in the entire world, 10 times the amount of Indonesia. Anyway, off my rant. That's a side note. We need to stop bulldozing the bush over here. It's really bad. Please sign all the petitions. So the pale-headed snake is beautiful little thing. Slow growing, we find. We've got two of them. They've got some really nice color patterns on the head. And they live under the bark of really old trees that are exfoliating the bark outwards, these iron barks. Along creek lines, these trees often are, like Eucalyptus crebra, that sort of thing. There's more. How long do your listeners want to listen to the list of species we've got? We've got two Dajar death adders. So that's a rough scale death adder. That's Acanthophis rugosus. They're huge. They're awesome. They're sisters. They were in the same litter, but their personality is truck and cheese. That's another story. We've got three green pythons, green tree pythons. So two are juveniles in the yellow form stage, and then one that has done its lovely transition to the green stage. So they're quite fun. And then we've
Yeah,
got
are those guys
five Woma pythons. Oh yeah.
and are those guys more like the Iron Range locale, or what locale are those green trees?
Yeah, we've got an Iron Range locale, and then we've got Aru Islands one. So I'm preferential to Iron Range one because I've seen like 60 of those in the wild, and just that to me seems like a green python, not these weird looking ones. Seems like, it's just these morphs that people breed, but fair enough if they're just a different locality. But Yeah, no, they're pretty stunning, and just to see them caught a lure is good fun. You know, you don't see much behavior in snakes, but that's a cool behavior. And they start to get
Yeah.
used to you being the, you know, one that brings a prey, and they caught a lure at you. You're like, oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, that's look. I'll stop there. We've got more, but
And a partridge in
it's
a
a
pear
big long
tree.
laundry list. Yeah.
So, do you guys also have any sorts of lizards at the academy, or is it mostly just snakes?
No, we do too. Yeah, we've got some cool monitor lizards. We've got a Merton's water monitor lizard. So he should be about 30 years old. His name's Veggie. We've got a mangrove monitor lizard. So he's a beauty. He's got this huge enclosure that Chris built, and he's got 400 liter, don't know how many gallons. But anyway, I can sit in the pond. It's huge. It's really nice. He loves swimming in that. Climbing up on branches, that sort of thing. So mangrove monitor, and then we've got these things called Epsies, which are Agernia epsi solis. They're these small little eastern Pilbara spiny-tailed skinks, the common name, and they're orange and black, and they're just awesome with their spiky tails and their thick fleshy tongue, and easy to feed because you don't need crickets. Crickets are annoying. So yeah, we've got some blue tongue skinks. We've got western blue tongue and the common blue tongue. So they're quite cool. One of them's 520 millimeters long. He's like almost the whole length of your arm. It's very impressive. It's no wonder why some people think they look like snakes, you know, with their little legs sort of get tucked underneath when they're running along quickly. They get called for snake call out sometimes. It's quite funny. I
Well,
think
they're
that's all
patterning.
the
It.
lizards.
I was gonna say, I've had noticed. Blue tongue skinks. Their patterning almost kind of resembles a death adders in terms of how they're banded.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. People think they're tiger snakes, definitely. If they don't see the head or the legs, then absolutely. And if you're not, you know, I don't know, a herp. To us, you're like, how on earth? But someone who's like, you know, scared, and they just see this image and it's roughly resembling a snake and they know it moved, it has some patterns, they're like, oh my God, it's a snake and I'm scared and I need it removed.
Yeah.
So it happens sometimes. Which is the store's monitor, and he's a pygmy monitor, and he's cute, and his name is Little. He eats crickets. He's naughty that he won't get off his cricket, so that's a bit annoying.
Yeah. And because this is the Croc Cast podcast, I have to ask, does the Academy do any work with crocodilians?
No. Sorry, listeners. You have to expand your herp interest beyond the crocs. Chris has worked with crocs in the past when he was working with another company. He's done a fair amount of work. That was just like, you know, the public being able to have a ch but yeah, we made the choice not to have crocs. You know, they're a little bit involved. You know, they need a big amount of space, and these, you know, you got to manage the water. And there's just not that much interest for us in terms of us training people how to handle reptiles. If anything, it'd be monitor lizards that they would want to be able to capture for on-site sort of, you know, fauna spotter catching, you know, managing wildlife for the industry. That's of interest, but crocodiles is very minute number of people, and it's just people basically who work at zoos, and in which case you just get trained by someone else at the zoo.
Yeah, for 99.99% of people, the amount of here's your steps for handling a crocodilian. Step one, don't.
Yeah, you see these people like in the Everglades who want to just think alligator, and they just get torn up, and it's like, well, fair enough. Yeah, this thing thinks it's and they underestimate them because they see that they don't move much, but hey, when they need to, they absolutely will.
Yeah, at least it wasn't a Salty or a Nile.
True. Yeah, absolutely. I would not want to encounter one of them, that's for sure.
Yeah. So earlier on, you mentioned you did some work with king cobras and their venom. You want to talk about that real quick?
Yeah, sure. So I didn't Venom work, by the way, it's people just buying venom from other suppliers that do this for a living. So anybody who's interested in studying venom, they often think, oh, I get to have this like glorious field work, interact with snakes, and then I'll test the venom. No, vast majority, I'd say like 98% of the venom work is not that. It was a rare case that I was able to include it, but that's just because I happened to be able to win a grant to be able to go and do this sort of field work. It's often just so expensive and yeah, time consuming and dangerous, right? So anyway, we got this venom shipped into us from our suppliers, and then we're just looking at the preferential toxicity toward different taxon. So yeah, we tested it against humans, rats, mice, which is different again, and then birds, and I might be missing one just off memory. And it hit most of these targets in a fairly low manner, in terms of how much light it shifted by its binding on this biosensor, it's called. And however, when we test it with snake, it just boom! So it really bound to the snake. It's like that toxin was designed to hit that target. So that was a really cool find, because of course, Ophiophagus, like snake loving, snake eating rather. That's what they do. They target snakes. And so, yeah, just I guess a nice opportunity to remind people that you want to keep king cobras around. They're not the things that are biting people and killing people. In fact, that's why most of these countries don't even carry king cobra anti-venom. You look at Bali in Indonesia, they don't even have king cobra anti-venom because, it's a zero-sum game, how much money they've got for, their medical systems over there. So they look at what the cases are, and then they pay for the production of the anti-venom for the things that are causing the most trouble, and it's not king cobras. So it's just nice to be able to remind people that they eat other snakes, they keep a nice balance of the ecosystem, super important, and we should totally respect these, the longest venomous snake in the world. And it's really great that we found there's researchers have found recently there's that many more species. And so it means that in each place they need the protection. You can't just be like, oh, okay, that one island over there has got them, so we're not going to lose them in the world. Well, it does no good for the ecosystems or all the other places that they live if you don't have, this predator there. So yeah, a little bit of a longer answer than just what we found about venom, but there you go.
I'm obviously not speaking from first-hand experience here, but I have heard from people who have worked with king cobras that they are a lot different than true cobras, and that they seem a lot more thoughtful, maybe is the word.
Yeah, I can see where they're
Maybe a
coming
lot
from.
more cognizant of the situations going on.
I mean, I've interacted and handled some king cobras and some regular cobras like Java and spitting cobra. And in comparison with the individuals that I work with, I totally agree with that sentiment that there's, they're a large animal that can't move super quickly, and so they're really thinking about what they're going to do. And it's as opposed to like a spitting cobra, for one, it can spit, but for two, it can, evade a predator much more readily than a big king cobra. So yeah, it way less, they'll stand up, try to do this intimidation, and that whole hissing thing, that's very impressive. So it's all about preventing that interaction that can reduce the chance of it being harmed, and it can hopefully, yeah, get away unscathed. But I found them, yeah, very cool to interact with. And I know the people who work with them, they just fall in love with them. And they get really sad when they see, people kill them. The tracking project, found almost all the king cobras ended up dying over the several years, and either from being like run over or killed, persecuted. And you just wonder, well, these things must live to a long age to get so big. Their populations have to be dwindling in a lot of places. Snake conflict, killing king cobras is not the way to do it. So education's needed for sure.
Yeah. Speaking of that human snake conflict, and we touched on this a little bit with the you mentioned Queensland and its deforestation, but what are some steps people can do to mitigate human snake conflict and to help with local conservation?
And foremost thing that someone can do to try to coexist and improve snake conservation is to learn more about snakes, to understand them a little bit better. There is some good information out there. We just need to avoid the myths and, these stories and pubs, these tall tales that just, the fish keeps getting bigger and bigger, every time you tell that story. So I think it would be great if there's some more research for snakes so we can understand them better. There's about half as many research papers coming in about snakes than are relative to other taxa, relative to the number of species are in the represented in the tree of life. So, for instance, just to give some context there, like snakes make up 14% of the vertebrate species on the planet, but only 7% of the papers. And it's almost the opposite effect when you look at birds. So you have way more papers relative to the actual number of species. And it's just because, I guess twofold, people are really interested in birds. They love them. But they're also more accessible. That's be part of it too. But a lot of it comes down to funding. And I think it would be really nice to see the tide sort of turn to, incorporate new information about snakes, understand them a little bit better. People want to coexist with snakes. I mean, the biggest thing is habitat. Don't destroy forests for the climate, carbon storage, all the rest of it. It's the huge thing for snake conservation. And basically, I mean, definitely every species in Australia, the number one cause of their demise. There's other factors, but deforestation is the number one. For us, invasive species is sort of a close second in a lot of cases, feral cats and roaming cats. But I mean, as an individual, what they can do in their own property, plant native plants, locally native plants. I'm not talking, just native to your continent. We can do a little bit better than that. Things evolved with plants that lived in that local area. So that's the best way to support local species in the ecosystem, plant locally native plants, keep the leaf litter, don't blow the leaves, don't have biodiversity hating lawn or limit the amount that you have. And I think the more of us do this, the more of a social norm it becomes. I'm the only one on my street that has planted all natives and has no lawn. And people look and they wonder, and like, so I think there's a lot of them are scared. My neighbors and just all these other communities are scared to go against the norm. But let's choose something that makes sense. I don't have to mow it. Noise pollution, that carbon pollution, that waste of time. And instead, I can support all the pollinators and the butterflies and the skink lizards. And sure enough, even if people don't like snakes, they're important too, and they're providing 24/7 vermin control for us. You imagine a world without snakes. We'd be overrun with rats and mice and the ticks and fleas that come along with those vermin, right? And so the disease prevalence would probably go up. And so they're providing these huge ecosystem services for us. And they were here millions of years before humans. So I think we owe it to them to just, give a little instead of just take everything.
All right. And sounds like a good ending point. So how can people reach out to you and reach out to the Academy and find out more about the Academy?
Yeah, sure. I guess the quickest, most visual way would be on Instagram. So we're Chris and Christina on Instagram. So it's chris.ann.christina. We are also on Facebook. We're working on a website for all those folks. It's just it's a long and expensive process, a bit annoying, but it'll get there. And yeah. Other than that, I mean, we threw out some research we put on those pages as well. But if anyone's traveling to Australia and coming through Brisbane, you might want to join our course and can see about 10 different Australian species and get to handle and interact with them for the day. Totally understand if you want to see them out in the bush. Good luck finding them. But yeah, we've got them here, and get in touch. If you want to do a course at this stage, it's emailing us at AustralianReptileAcademy@gmail.com. And you can find out our schedule. We generally, as I said, run them about once a month, and we'll set a course date 1, max sort of 2 months ahead of time, just so everyone knows.
All right. And with that, thanks for coming on the show.
All right. Thanks for having me. All the best.